This is PWTorch.com editor Wade Keller, along with Torch columnist Bruce Mitchell, and this is the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show, Part 2, for Saturday, January 8th, 2011. Well, Bruce, since we recorded yesterday, Gabe Sapolsky posted on his Facebook page the following. So, evidently, Bruce Mitchell just spent an entire audio running down DGUSA. I'd like to do a little poll here. How many people know who Bruce Mitchell is and read his stuff? I'm especially interested in fans under 25 years old. Thank you. Do you have anything to say to that?
Yeah, I do. I have a lot to say to that.
Okay.
In the first place, let me just.
I'm surprised. I'm sorry.
By the way, before we started, I told Wade, let me just get through what I had to say, and then. And so he interrupted me.
Okay, I'm going to actually.
The psychology of this is.
I know.
Amazing.
I'm going to file my nails and just, you know, hit the mute button. So.
First off, I'm 51 years old. I've been a wrestling fan for a long time. I mean, that's. And number two, I'm not aware that there is a young wrestling fan surge in Dragon Gate USA's attendance. I did not know that. In fact, there's not. So the idea that I'm too old, and that's what the insinuation is, that I'm too old to understand what the fresh new type of wrestling that's coming through is. If there was a fresh new style of professional wrestling, I've been critical of Chikara. Chikara was really taking off attendance-wise. It was the new coming thing in pro wrestling, and I watched it and studied it and said I didn't understand why that is. Because back in my day, that wrestlers did blah, 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 I think that would be a valid criticism. To insinuate, like I said, it's an insinuation that I'm too old to understand what Dragon Gate is doing or that it's successful, I think is kind of stupid. I mean, I think that it's the idea. But the other thing that I wanted to say about this is, let me be real blunt about this. More people pay to listen to what I say about professional wrestling, to read what I write about professional wrestling, than attend or buy Dragon Gate products. And so I don't want to hear, that thing of no one knows who I am, so what I say doesn't count. No one follows what I've been doing for 20 years. No one's followed me in 2010, 2011. Maybe they did in years past. Doesn't hold water. WWE might be able to get away with saying something like that because they have millions and millions of wrestling fans and people who watch their shows, but it's just a fact that more people subscribe to Pro Wrestling Torch and listen to its various platforms or use its various platforms than do to Dragon Gate USA. And so that one, that criticism is not fair. Now, the other part of that, to switch to it, it doesn't matter. That's not what counts. What counts is not how old I am or what I look like or how long I've been doing this or how long I haven't been doing this or any of those things or how many people listen to me or read what I write or read the quiz or listen to that audio compared to how many listen to Dragon Gate USA. One reason is because they watch Dragon Gate USA or pay for the products of Dragon Gate USA. One of the reasons is, quite frankly, they're two different businesses. But the other reason is, what I'm doing, what counts is not who said it, but what was said. The ideas that I talked about in that audio, the ideas that were the basis of those two quiz questions, that's what you can debate. And Gabe Sapolsky isn't doing that. He's trying to make it a personal thing. He's trying to make it personal with me, as I said, about that whatever I say is not valid because of my age, or whatever I say is not valid because not enough people listen to it. It's not who I am. It's the ideas that I put forth. It's the ideas by themselves. And, I think that we showed him some respect yesterday. We showed his promotion some respect yesterday by talking about the ideas of what's going on in the promotion and why the promotion has empty seats when you turn on their shows. At the level that they're doing, and that has not grown the way I think that they would expect to grow, and not grow in the way that would make this an ongoing successful thing. And I think we're pushing to figure out why. And I think that's something that would be useful to a business owner. I really do. I can understand the disappointment that he would have, and particularly because that's not something that he's faced with every day, except for, as I said, in his business results. And, Sean Radican said, I've never had anybody, sent me an email and said, I've never had anybody tell me I watched that show and it was a terrible show or it was a crappy show or something. Not one person's ever said that, ever emailed me to say that. And, my answer to that is how many people just didn't go? How many people just skipped reading about Dragon Gate USA? How many people have gone and then didn't come back? How many people have been invited to go or know about it and just say, no thanks, because they can't hook into a star, they can't hook into something. Now, I understand that, one of the criticisms is, I mean, not one of the criticisms, one of the responses is, well, they're trying to do that now. And that's fine, I would say, that's fine, but the way I understand it is they're getting the cliques together, the factions together, and having them go against each other and that kind of thing. We've seen that doesn't, unless you get that focus on, unless you get that focus on somebody who can perform at a level to really draw people into what challenges they're facing, what dragons they're slaying, what how they're doing it. I mean, how they're rolling through their career. You're still going to have the same sort of thing. And yeah, I noticed one thing when you put the audio show, the first audio show, the one that we talked about, Dragon Gate USA, on. It was something about, it's still 3.5 and 4-star matches, but does that make a good show? And my argument's one step farther than that, that if it's the type of matches that are designed for you to go ooh and ah, and to ooh and ah one person's spot, and then ooh and ah the next person's spot as they build, I think there's something fundamentally wrong with those type of matches, because we've seen that they do not, and for the reasons we talked about in that last hour, they do not sustain interest for people, or for very few people. And, it's that you desensitize people because they're not into the stories, they're not into the characters, they're just waiting for the next thing that's going to wow them. And that's, as we talked about yesterday, it's a tough nut to crack. But like I said, Gabe, I tried to look up how old Gabe Sapolsky is. I wasn't able to do that. It's not on his Facebook page, but he's not so far away from my age. And, I would think that knowing something, learning something through the years would be an advantage. I think it is. But it really doesn't matter, like I said, what color my hair is, how old I am, how old I'm not.
What color is your hair?
It's what those ideas. What color is my hair?
What color is your hair? I thought it was just, kind of dark brown and a little gray.
We'll go with that.
All right.
That's almost accurate. I would say one of those adjectives is changing. But
mine is two, and I've got that. You've got more than a decade on me, and I'm probably more gray than you. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I haven't seen you in
a year. I need to send that picture in. But and I also know I've played this game before because I've been around for a while. I played this game before when they start pointing a finger at your appearance or pointing a finger at age or all these different things, personal things about you, and the person that's upset with you doesn't talk about the ideas, then that's something of a compliment in a very strange way. I think I've dealt with Gabe fairly professionally through the time, and particularly since I've had these criticisms, and I don't know. That was disappointing. I wasn't happy about it. But like I said, if it's who listens to you and who watches you, more people listen and read my stuff than watch Dragon Gate USA. That's just a fact. And pay to do it.
Yeah, my issue is I thought the discussion that we had was brought on by one thing, Sean Radican's email question. I mean, normally we take we take subscriber questions, but Sean asked a very specific question. And in fairness to you, Bruce, and to me as the host, compared to what Gabe said, it wasn't let's just arbitrarily say there's a pay-per-view tonight and here's why nobody should order it or why they're going to fail. It was a very specific response to a colleague of ours who wanted to know a very specific question. And he's like, how can you not take into account a show with matches that have all got reviews from prominent reviewers giving 3.5, 3.75 stars to matches? That's what our discussion was about. And it was, why is a card full of 3 to 3.75 star matches not necessarily a formula for is not necessarily a show that is going to be massively appealing to people. And it turned into a philosophical discussion on what you think makes wrestling tick. And it's your point of view. And I don't – what frustrated me about the way Gabe did it, and I mean Gabe has a reputation for, you know, being temperamental or maybe that's not the best word for it, but, you know, not super even keel and kind of reactive in certain ways. You know, Rob Feinstein was kind of the good cop and Gabe was kind of the grumpy guy. In the early years of ROH, and that's kind of Gabe's rep. And Gabe's always treated me great. I mean, I've never had an issue with the way that Gabe has treated me in person or as a promoter dealing with me as a reporter. But nevertheless, his reputation is such where this comment, I guess, doesn't surprise me a lot, but I'm a little disappointed still because it wasn't a one-hour job demeaning and ripping DG USA. It was responding to a specific question from Sean Radican about is a show full of high star ratings. It's not like it was 4, 4.5 and 4.75. It's 3, 3.5, 3.75. Is that enough to sustain a wrestling promotion? And that was, it was, I mean, I know you got into more things, Bruce, but that was really the impetus for the discussion. So I think the way Gabe framed it for his people on his Facebook page is a little disappointing in the sense that I think we tried really, I mean, I think we treated DGUSA fairly. We have a point of view. You have your point of view, I have mine, and it was much more about your point of view yesterday. But what we did is we answered a question from Sean Radican very specifically, and I thought, like you said, did it in a respectful manner where somebody could listen and go, I disagree with Bruce strongly. But you know what? He took an hour to explain himself, and he did so in a way that wasn't personal, and it showed no axe to grind. There was no, I'm upset at Gabe, or I'm mad at Gabe because he spends money on another website. He advertises on another website and gives them a bunch of money and they're our competition. It's like there was none of that. It's not like that, you know. And so that's what's disappointing is that for something he's responding to something very specifically. It'd be like us not watching last night's pay per view and specifically saying last night's pay per view was something. You know, we generally as a practice don't write reviews on specific shows that we don't watch. And I kind of thought Gabe just did that in his Facebook comment going, I understand, blah, blah, blah. So he took hearsay and oversimplified what we did. And I think that's disappointing because our discussion on DGUSA was a much broader overall response to something that Sean Radican emailed to us. So that's I guess that's my point of view on that. Cause, okay,
no,
sure.
I did. I know. I completely agree with you. I know I'm like, that it's too cozy. I mean, I guess you wouldn't listen to my response, but when there's like they're kind of together and they're kind of doing it, and it's just, you know, it's like how they're marketing something. They're saying you should get this show. It's like that's too cozy. That's too. Yeah. It brings up too many questions. And you could say I would have liked the show anyway, and I believe that that's true.
Yeah.
But and
okay.
And
I'll add this too, Bruce. I think with Sean Radican, I'm proud to say that Sean, among the people who are prominent reviewers of the show, he's not negotiating ad rates for his pay. Like, he's writing those because he genuinely loves these shows. And he does have a passion for the product. And that's fine. He asked a very specific question, you, Bruce. You answered it. But I'm proud to say that at least when people read Sean Radican's reviews, they're getting his point. They're getting his point of view. And there's no issue with the fact that there's quid pro quo going on or there's ads for that pay-per-view that were paid for plastered right next to his review. I'm glad that at The Torch, our policy has been, no, we don't do that. I mean, we literally turn away ads from people inquiring us, wanting to give us money for advertising products that we review. And the answer is no. You know, we turn that money away. And some of these other companies that Gabe is, you know, touting on his website and not saying, you know, things about, not running negative campaigns with his Facebook visitors about, those are people who he's sending money to. You know, so I don't like that aspect of this either. But I don't know that at all motivated Gabe's specific comments towards you. But I'd just like to say that if we reviewed a show that we didn't watch and gave it a low score or characterized a specific show as something that it wasn't, that would be disappointing. And we were, like I said, just final comment for me is we were responding directly to a broad question from Sean Radican about why seeing high star ratings in the 3-star range for a show led to the type of response that you had to the show. And so I just think it's unfair, you know, for Gabe. I'm not saying he owes us an apology or anything like that. That's up to him. But I just think it's disappointing the way that he kind of reacted to that.
Yeah, I mean, disappointing. I was a little pissed. So And I said, what I had to
say. Well, I don't blame you because now, you know, and this happened with Vince Russo too. I'm sure Gabe's going to love the comparison, but Vince Russo is a guy who went on his Facebook page and mischaracterized things that you said because he wasn't happy with the, I mean, he's used to people just giving him glowing reviews. He's used to being fawned over by prominent reporters, also the ones that he pays to run ads on their websites. And that may or may not change their opinions, but I think it might affect him that he can't give us money to pay to advertise his product. And it probably has nothing to do with it, but it might frustrate him that there isn't that sense of maybe I have some control over what Bruce Mitchell says, and it's so out of the ordinary that somebody would say things that maybe if he listened would make him think and go, oh, you know, okay. Or maybe not. You know, I mean, trust me, Bruce.
I think part of it, too, is just simply, and Sean writes this to me, and this is Radican's big comeback to me is, everybody, here's a list of people that really love this stuff and they're respected people. He listened, and he did it yesterday. And I think that, as you said, they're used to getting, you know, Dragnet USA has some very good qualities to it that gets them from prominent people in this industry, in our side of the industry, you know, very good reviews. So when someone turns around and says no and says, here's why, they're not, you know, they're not used to it. And part of the model is built on appealing to the type of people who the Torch would appeal to and who would, you know, who would really go in depth in their, you know, in their wrestling passion.
Right.
And I understand the psychology of that. And I understand him wanting to answer me. I don't like being, I don't like the attempt to say what I say doesn't matter because, not because of what the ideas are, but because of who I am. I don't appreciate that. So,
I agree with that. I mean, I think that you have a right to be ticked off about that. And that was a cheap shot from Gabe. And if Gabe turns out to be the most successful promoter, or just a very successful promoter to a niche audience of people under 25, but he happens to be in his 50s, you know, I'm not going to discount his success based on the fact that he's in his 50s. I'll say, hey, that guy's been around. He's learned some lessons, and he's applied those lessons, and he's marketed successfully to a group of young people. Gabe isn't exactly Mr. MTB. So, it just was a weird approach and disappointing approach to take. But as for what I was saying about Vince Russo, when Vince Russo would mischaracterize things that you or I would write, then all the people on the Facebook page would, you know, make all these nasty comments. And, I mean, it's like, if people were making those kind of comments about somebody on my Facebook page, I'd delete them. I mean, it's just people who don't know who you are. There's crass sexual comments and stuff like that. And it's rally the troops around me because my feelings were hurt. And I just think he should be above that too.
Now, having said that, you read some of them to me. You just went down the line and started reading. Some of them were real negative. Some of them I've heard before. Some of them weren't.
Yeah,
and there was at least one that I remember that said maybe this is something you ought to give some consideration to, and this was, you know,
absolutely. I just think Gabe is above taking the Vince Russo approach of the populist. You know, I've got my circle of friends at the popular kids lunch table here, and I'm gonna my circle of friends lunch table, and now we're all just gonna get in a groupthink mentality and jump on a guy who maybe we've never heard of. And granted, all Gabe said is, "Have you heard of him?" He didn't say, "Let's rip on him," but those comments are sitting there, you know, and it's there.
And the difference between, you know, Vince Russo, his world can't have someone like me in it because he's got he's not smart enough, he doesn't have enough knowledge or talent to deal with the things that I brought up about him. There's so much worse and so much more egregious than Gabe Sapolsky can. Gabe Sapolsky, I think, should be able to handle what, and I expect that he would be able to handle the things that I've talked about with that and understand them. And you know, and he may reject them, and clearly he does. But,
well, not necessarily.
You know, but
I mean, I don't know that he's heard the arguments enough to reject them. I mean, you two had a discussion where, as you put it, he kind of lectured you for an hour and wasn't interested in, you know, he was kind of came prepared with his guns a-blazing to respond to things you had already said. It wasn't exactly a back-and-forth discussion for most of the time. But he didn't hear yesterday's discussion at the time he posted that Facebook article based on the tone of his post. So I don't even think he's discounting what you said. He might actually listen to what you said and go, wow, you know, Bruce is right about a lot of things that he said, but here's a key fact that causes me to do what I do. You know, and you know, his response might be, I agree with everything Bruce says, but that talent's not available to me. Or I as a businessman, am nervous to push any one wrestler because we don't make enough money to afford to be held up and have the fans be built around one guy. So I have to empower myself to make it the style that keeps us successful. Even if that limits our growth, it keeps me from being held up or feeling at the mercy of one or two guys who I got over. And I hate it. Bruce is right about everything he said, and I hate that I'm limited in this way. But I am, and fortunately we're making just enough money the way we do things that hopefully we'll grow from here. I mean, I'm just saying there might be a response that he would have where he doesn't disagree with you. He just says, I've got circumstances that maybe Bruce doesn't know about that leads me to do what I do, the way that I do it. But that's an intelligent – that's what I said about Eric Bischoff on the live cast when people were asking me, why does Eric always bring up your name weight on the other podcast that he does? And, you know, it's like know-it-alls and geniuses and wrestling experts like Wade Keller, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you know, he does it, I think, to make it seem like it's personal. You know, there's nothing – I think people who hear something they don't want to hear from a critic – like to make it seem like any criticism from that critic is personal. So they try to make people think, oh, that guy just said that about him because they don't like each other. And I think Russo played that game. Bischoff played that game. Hardy played that game.
Yeah, and I've taken that for 20 years when that's come up with me for 20 years, is that they don't have an answer.
Yeah.
They know it's a valid criticism, and they're not interested in changing, and they're not interested in thinking about an answer.
Yeah.
And which is an affirmation of a sort. So yeah. I'm never that worried about it. But in this case, it's just, you know.
Gabe is using something that he was told you said to rally his supporters. I mean, it's the emails in a political season where, you know, one campaign says, did you hear what Sarah Palin said? And then the other side said, did you hear what Reverend Al Sharpton said? And it's to rally donations, and it's disingenuous. It's not intellectually honest. And frankly, it's patronizing to their own fans. But, you know, in a sense, I think Gabe's trying to get people to order this pay-per-view and buy his merchandise, despite that nasty Bruce Mitchell, who actually gave a well-reasoned one-hour discussion that was respectful about something in reply to something very specific Sean Radican asked, which wasn't, why do you hate DG USA and why does DG suck? You know, that wasn't the tone of the discussion. Well, anyway, Bruce, let's move on if you're not going to protest. What you talked about a little bit, but I want to explore a little bit more in terms of just indie wrestling in general. You said indie wrestling worked and could still work. What, look at all the indie shows and the evolution of it over time, and what external factors have changed what indie wrestling is today, especially for a newer fan listening to this or someone who's fascinated with the evolution of things. What did indie wrestling mean in 1983 versus 1988 versus the mid-90s versus now? You know, like, what journey has indie wrestling been on? What
external that's an interesting question. There's a lot to that.
Yeah.
One of the things about the territorial model of professional wrestling versus the national model of professional wrestling is that the territorial model, if you're talking about 83 or the 70s or something, there was indie wrestling. It wasn't called independent wrestling. It was called outlaw wrestling.
Yep.
Because the mafia that ran the territories, it was a mafia. They divided up the United States and the world into, a cable of a monopoly of promoters who protected each other, who sent talent to each other, and they didn't do such a good job of it all the time, much like the real mafia of protecting each other's, you know, territories and infringing on each other and not stealing talent or going into other people's criminal activities as the mafia would. And yes, I am mixing metaphors for a reason. But the outlaw shows, the indie shows, used wrestlers who were not on television in your particular area, and they might have used veterans who were on the outs or who were blackballed by the major promotions or who just weren't being used or too old or, you know, weren't viable anymore to put on a show to get fans who liked the wrestling that they saw on their television that the territory had, you know, to get the overflow of fans that wanted more wrestling. And they would have a lead babyface, a lead star, however pitiful that lead star may be, and a lead heel, however pitiful that guy may be, and they would fight over a title that you had never heard of. And they would and it would be structured very much like whatever type of wrestling was popular in your area. If it was tag team wrestling, then they would have tag teams. If it was singles wrestling, if it was whatever. And it would be, you know, it'd be eight wrestlers on the show. and you could run. They were, and you know, they would try to find enclaves where whatever the territory was wasn't running very many shows there, so they could run their regular, and they would run a regular schedule of shows, and they would last for however long they would last, but they would last for usually for a while. There wouldn't be big money, and there wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't draw as the same as the wrestling on television. Then when things went in the 80s to the national model and the territory faded away and there was two or three national companies or two national companies, WWF and Jim Crockett Promotions, or WWF, Jim Crockett Promotions, and AWA, and Memphis was around, and Memphis, that meant that there were experienced hands that weren't wrestling for the two national promotions for whatever reason. Some of them were very good hands, and I would look at Bruiser Brody and Abdullah the Butcher at the very top of this, who were draws who could be brought in by an independent promoter, and they were real draws. Bruiser Brody was a real draw. If he was on an indie show, the indie promoter could count on, you know, if he did a pretty good job of hyping a show, promoting a show, according to the ways people did that at the time, he could count on 500 more people if Bruiser Brody was on the show, just by the fact that Bruiser Brody was on the show. And then there would be wrestlers who were on the outs with WWF or on the outs with Jim Crockett. And they could headline shows. And particularly in the Northeast, you know, there would be, you know, there would be whoever, Jim Duggan or whoever it was that wasn't working at that time, could headline, you know, those Haluza used to do shows like this. The shows wouldn't be very athletic, but they would have wrestlers that had been on national television who could draw a crowd. And the key was to keep your talent budget down far enough so that whatever you drew, you would have more money. And independent wrestling promoters would try to do this. And they started failing more in the 80s at this. And some of them started forgetting it. And they would load up their shows with a bunch of names. But there were names that you could do that with. There were more acts. There were more polished acts back then. So there were wrestlers around that you know, if you were willing to fly them in, if you were willing to pay their price, you could have a show with an independent show with wrestlers who most wrestling fans had heard their name before or saw them on TV in recent years. But then as the business began to expand but also constrict, most of the wrestlers who made a real living were in the national promotions. There became this thing of independent promotions who were more, and I hate using this word, but I'm going to use it here. The promoters were marks. They weren't trying. Their first reason to run a wrestling show wasn't to make a buck. Those outlaw promoters back in the 70s or 80s, their first reason to do a show was to make a buck. Now, they may book themselves as a star, but they still were trying to, you know, they still were trying to have their revenues exceed their expenses and go home with the lion's share. If they're the promoter, lion's share of the money, and everybody on the show usually got paid. Nobody, there were wrestlers, most of the wrestlers, unless they were very young wrestlers, wouldn't think of working a show for free. That they just wouldn't do it. You know, if it was Billy Hines or Johnny Heidemann or whoever it was, you know, wrestling, you know, whatever old veteran that was wrestling an indie show in the area, you were going to have to pay him to get him to show up. And if you didn't pay him, you were going to have a problem. And they weren't going to show up ever again for you. As time went on, it was the promoter saw himself as somebody in a movie that was a successful wrestling promoter and wanted to pal around, wanted to meet stars and wanted to pal around with stars and be important to, you know, television stars, wrestling stars they'd seen on television. And so you would have these promoters that would have a lot of named stars and they would lose their shirt. They would last for a little while and they would lose their shirt and their lives would be ruined because they marked out for the idea of, I'm going to get these people together. I'm going to book them in ways that's going to work, and I'm going to become a real national big shot. And they usually just didn't have the knowledge or the talent or anything like that. They didn't have the money behind them, and they spent all their own money, and they were financially ruined. And like I said, they suffered, you know, mightily for it. And so that was sort of the model, and that was something to write about. I used to write about it in that time. Then there weren't, now in the last 10 years, there hasn't been as many named wrestlers even available. Their price is too high. And so what people have done is run their wrestling promotions, and they have been closet bookers, but they imitate what they see on television without any regard for whether it works or not. And then instead of paying the people that are there because 200 people come or 150 people come, I mean, it's embarrassing what they get. Or, you know, it's not uncommon to have less than 100 people at an indie show. It used to be that would be the last time the guy would run the show. Now you might have that every week, and it becomes a social club for the wrestlers that wrestle on the show. And they're very much about their spots, and they very much, there's a politics behind it. And so they get to have, you know, they get to have a clique of people instead of just a tag team, instead of the 8 people being on a show that draws 400 people, 23 people on a show that draws 87 people. But there's 23, all are pushed. So they all can say, I'm on this show, I'm an important part of the show, I'm not getting squashed, so they just don't tell me to roll out there and wrestle in the first match and don't go out of the ring. And they get to do everything they think they can do in the ring, whether they're in shape or can do it or not. And you get the, we're going to have a, you know, we're going to have, and they use the stipulations because it's, they use the stipulation way of booking, which is I'm going to have, we're going to have a four-way ladder match for whatever fake title, I mean, they're all titles, you know, whatever title that they say. And
some titles are more fake than others, Bruce. That's fair to say.
Huh?
Some titles are more fake than others.
Right. But I mean, you know, but I don't mean, but they serve a purpose, but their titles don't serve that much of a purpose. But all five of those guys say, I can go to their friends and say, I main evented at the show over at the rec center or whatever place they run.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they don't even know that their job is to bring in people. I mean, there are wrestlers now, and there are wrestlers in TNA like this. They don't even know that the job is to draw. They think the job is to show up and then to get the paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
But the job is to draw people into your thing, and same thing with that. They don't go, oh, God, they're not embarrassed by the fact that they were in front of so few people. They just think that's the way it is. And I remember a couple of years ago I went to a show like this, and there was a ladder match for the title. Two guys were doing a match, and it was one of those things where they did some things that were very athletic. They also did some things that were very dangerous and foolhardy, but they did them. And it was one spot led to another spot that was a little more dangerous and a little wilder. And this guy sitting next to me, I didn't know him. I was actually watching the show. He goes, boy, that was great. And he didn't know me. I said, no, that wasn't great at all. He goes, well, why do you say that? I mean, that guy went through that, and that guy went through that. And I said, did you notice as they started doing it, they were fighting over who could get to that title belt that's hanging up there, and both of them had chance after chance just to reach up and get it, and they stopped even trying to do that. They just started trying to fall through what they were falling through. They were doing, their purpose became to do spectacular spots, and they forgot what the point of the whole match was.
Yeah.
Because the spot still had to be in the context of, I'm going to get up there and get that title. But they had obvious chances to do it, and they were so focused on, we're going to set up so I can land on you again, that they forgot that they were supposed to do, you know, supposed to do that. And they wonder why they don't grow, you know, they wonder why they don't grow. And I do think, and the other thing with indie shows is they got the shows in the 70s and the shows in the 80s, most of them weren't great shows. Vast majority of them. They're definitely exceptions, but most of them weren't great shows. But the ones in the 70s and the 80s, it was just one guy was going to fight the other guy for the title, and that was the purpose of the show. And that was how it was booked. And it wasn't booked in a complicated way. And, in fact, usually the whoever the designated top star good guy was, he was going to win at the end of the night because they want to have people go home happy. As the early 90s came in, these indie shows had very complicated booking. On one hand, that was hard to kind of follow, particularly if you were just going out because the kids wanted to see wrestling, and it was in your local, it was at your local rec center, and you know, you didn't know who the people, they didn't establish who the stars were in the first, you know, who the people you're supposed to watch were in the first place. Then you had really complicated booking performed and executed by people, and this is not the case in Dragon Gate USA. They can perform exactly what he wants them to do. And it, in fact, it's not really, but performed by people who are out of shape and couldn't do what was asked of them in the first place. And so what you had was a big mess. And the way to, if you're going to have fun at an independent show, was to act up, for me and my friends, was to act up ourselves. Because the shows would be so bad that you were either laughing your way through them and having a good time, or you weren't coming back. And the people who are willing to laugh their way through bad wrestling shows, there's a lot less of those than even you'd think. And you wouldn't think they'd be very many.
What are the people doing who used to go to indie shows and fill 500, 600, 800 seats with at some, or even 350? Who were those people then, and what are they doing now instead?
Oh boy, that's a good question. I don't know, because you know there's this idea that they're watching UFC, and I think there's a little bit of something to that, because I honestly, when I go to the local watering hole or wherever it is, I go. When I go out to see UFC, I see some of the same people I used to see in the 80s and in the early 90s that would go to the big professional wrestling shows around here that I haven't seen in years and years and years. And I see a few that, you know, might show up in Charlotte for the Fan Fest. It literally is, I haven't seen that guy. Look, there he is, you know.
But the indie, Bruce, that the indie shows that I've been to for MMA –
yeah,
those crowds don't look like necessarily the same. It's not like those people I expected to see at an indie show. If an indie show was successful, they're not entirely mutually exclusive, and it depends on the venue. And a lot of times, you know, when you go to an independent MMA show, what you're going to are a bunch of people who know one of the fighters on the card. And they bought tickets to go see them fight.
I don't think that like it's the same people. I don't think they all. I was gonna say I don't buy that they're all going to UFC now.
Right. Is it quote the internet? Is it because there's so much wrestling on TV now? People kind of get their fill. Why would somebody who wants to get out of the house who used to say I'm gonna go see indie wrestling? Or is it just a lack of good indie wrestlers? Is it a lack of that star to draw them to the building, or a lack of? Is it the aging out of indie promoters who knew what the hell they were doing?
I think it's a lot of this. I think it's all those things all together. And I think that also it's what pro wrestling, and I mean WWE and TNA, that style of pro wrestling. That the people that have gotten interested in who might go to an indie show, they go to an indie show. And what their definition in their mind of what pro wrestling is a very expensively produced show that indie promoters have a very hard time duplicating, that you can't just go on and have a decent sound system and that's it. I mean, I know there's one promotion I go to see from time to time, and they have their version of a Titantron.
Yep.
But it's still not as nice, and still doesn't have the impact. And they can't, you know, they'd be foolish to, like, do pyro and any of that. And so it's
WWE can't even afford to do pyro anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think that that's part of, that Vince McMahon has raised the stakes of what pro wrestling looks like. It's hard to imitate on an independent basis. I think that, you know, I think that indie promotions.
So did Eric Bischoff, but yeah.
Yeah. Should simplify what they're doing. I'm not counting Dragon Gate and Ring of Honor this, but although I think in certain ways they would benefit from this. But I think an indie promotion that doesn't have television that runs versus having a website and is a local standby, you should be able to understand and explain what happened on the show in very direct ways.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that you've had to go to every show and seen every little thing and all that, particularly when. And as I said, particularly when the talent level isn't up there, and there's good talent and there's not so good talent, but the talent level can't execute these very complicated stories. And I don't think people want the complicated stories. I think that's ego. That's if I have this real complicated story, I can keep my crew happy and involved. And I think they would be. I think that a lot of. I think that counting the number of wrestlers on a show, on an indie show, is an the number of main events and the number of wrestlers on the show is an inverse proportion to the quality of the show.
I love in Memphis when there'd be like some reason that a bunch of wrestlers didn't show up to the TV taping, and like or an indie show, but especially you know the TV. And Jerry Lawler, if he showed up and he had like three guys to work with, he could do a 90-minute show. You know, between Jerry Lawler, Lance Russell, and three other wrestlers, you could do a 90-minute show.
Because they knew they had wrestlers that could communicate and do stuff. But it was also,
yeah.
You don't have to be, you know, they think that you've got to have these swerves, these big angles. And they very much follow that Vince Russo model, and it's because it keeps the people who are working on the show happier because they have something to do.
Yeah.
But even if they can't, and even if they can't do it, they still have something to do. And again, it's all this wasted motion. You know, sometimes in art, it's just the one brushstroke in the right place.
Yeah.
You know, and that's and that's part of it. But I mean, the indie scene is just at its all time, you know. Low, where roller derby with no national television, roller derby shows, much less MMA shows, roller derby shows can out, you know, I would bet, you know, on an average outdraw independent wrestling shows.
Yeah,
there's less of them, but the ones that there are, you know, draw several hundred fans. Where an indie show, you go, if it draws 300 fans, you go, wow, that was a big success, even though it lost money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. You know, that idea of the independent promoters, most of them today that I hear about or that I read about or that I go to see don't have, you know, just these sad sack characters that don't know that the first thing you do is you make a list of all your expenses to run the show. And then you think of the price point that you can afford to charge and you count all the seats in the arena and you multiply that by the seats in the arena and you see whether if you sell it out, would you make any money at all? Can you pay your expenses? They don't even do that.
Yeah.
When you're at that level of business, and when you're that level of business, I mean, I don't have to tell you have to pay attention to a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with the content of the torch. You better pay attention to the content of the torch too.
Yeah.
You have to pay attention to, you know, whether this adds up, whether it's worth, you know, whether you can pay the people, but and yourself, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah,
and you know that's a big part. I mean, I've gone to show. I mean, I can remember going to a show that had Terry at a rec center in Lenoir, North Carolina, a few years ago. They had Terry Funk, it had Dusty Rhodes, it had Jeff Jarrett with the NWA TNA title. It had about five other wrestlers right off of TNA television from the time. And I walked into the place and I said, this place holds about 1,500 people. And it drew about 1,100 people. And flying in the talent that was on the show, there was no way in hell he made us. Not only that, if he'd have packed the place out, he would have lost several thousand. He still would have lost several thousand dollars.
Yeah.
And sure enough, and this guy... The guy who ran this show, his father was an independent promoter, was an outlaw promoter in North Carolina in the 70s. So he had grown up seeing these little shows run and how it worked. Well, it was this show and the next show that he ran. Turned out he'd run up not only his family's credit cards, but his wife's personal credit cards to this enormous amount of money, and his wife divorced him. And I don't know what happened to him after that except for it ruined his life.
Yeah.
So, you know, and so that's the higher scale, and then there's the smaller scale. So, to quote the guy who was sitting in the doorway in Purple Rain at First Avenue, the manager of the club, this is a business. You know, so
yeah.
You know, even I mean, you know, even that women's show, you and I, you know, so I had a great time with y'all at that show, but it had too many expensive acts, women's acts on the show, and the guy lost a lot of money.
Yeah,
that ran it. It was clear, you know, and he had a decent crowd, but there was no way that. There was no way that it was that he had a business model that was going to work.
Yeah.
And that's also that there are no Bruiser Brodies, and that there are no acts that are in that are not with a national company, or even with TNA that you can hire. That you will get that whatever their price is, that you will get a return of more than what you paid them. I don't know who. In fact, I don't know who that who that is. And the biggest story this year to me in wrestling has been the national downturn in business, but also just it's really come to roost for me how few jobs there are, and how few jobs there are for full time wrestlers in this in this business, and then. Shelton Benjamin is a very polished performer. He's been on television for several years, but I wouldn't hire him to be on my indie show because people aren't going to come out to see him. Enough people aren't going to come out to buy tickets to pay for what he charges.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you really would want a profit margin of, you'd hope that they would, where whatever Brody was that charged, you better pay him, but whatever Brody was that charged, there was a chance that more people would turn out and he would be worth having on the show.
Yeah.
There was a chance. It wasn't a guarantee. There was a chance. And my advice to you was to have my advice to anybody back then would be to have the money in hand for him, whether it drew or not.
All right, this is Wade Keller breaking in with a post-edit. We're going to break part two into two sections since we went more than 90 minutes, just so that the length of these don't get too unruly. So that ends part two, and just look for part three coming up here. It'll be 45 more minutes in length covering other subjects.